Hello and welcome to AFPT Comics Podcast, episode 68. My name is David Brook. I'm here with Forrest Hollingsworth. Forrest, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing great.
That's great. That's great to hear. Some fantastic comic book news came out this week that gives us some light at the end of the tunnel. But before we get there, I just want to point out that we will have Mark Russell on later in the show to talk about, well, Billionaire Island, Flintstones, Captain America, his new book at Marvel Comics. But yeah, this is the comic book podcast where we talk the news and we focus in on comic book criticism in a sense, aren't we? We're still doing that.
Yes. It felt a little bit like a trick question, to be honest.
I'm at the book club.
Yeah, we are still doing the book club.
Yes. This week, tell our lucky winners what they're going to get.
So we are going to be talking about Jeff Lemire's recent crossover, a 5-issue miniseries, Justice League Black Hammer, Hammer of Justice.
You know, it's funny. I just realized when you said it that the Hammer of Justice is like a flip of the Justice League. You know what I mean?
Yep. That's how they do.
The hardcover for that came out April 8th, so it is well timed that we'll be talking about that book. But before we get there, though, let's talk about the news. And there's some big, big news. The top of the pile of our news is the fact that DC Comics has announced a new distribution model and that books will be coming out April 27th.
Yeah.
So, so DC's basically figured out a way around Diamond while Diamond remains closed.
Yeah, the 20-year Diamond monopoly. I don't know if this is going to be temporary or permanent. DC initially canceled all of their orders for titles solicited April 1st to 15th with retailers and then told them to resubmit their orders through Diamond, Lunar, or UCS, depending on the region. Obviously, Diamond for North America. But they just announced recently that they are entering the distribution market with two large names that people might have heard of. They are B2B, which is business-to-business distributors. They're also B2C in the case of Midtown Comics in New York City at the very least, and then DCBS is going to be their other partner, and that's Discount Comic Book Source. Maybe it's just Discount Comic Books. I can't ever remember. I use in stock trades, so what do I know?
Discount Comic Book Service.
Oh, and so basically they have announced this partnership. It's very, very new. DC reassured retailers that they can continue with Diamond, with comics being based on when Diamond is able to continue distributing them. And then it confirms that they're not distributing collectibles through this service.
So essentially, it's a stopgap. And I don't think they're not coming out saying, you know, we're not going to be using Diamond or anything like that.
No, basically, they're saying to get books to businesses, we're using Lunar and USC, which is, again, based on where you are. And then to get books to customers, we're using Midtown and DCBS right now.
And they've also pointed out that they're not necessarily shipping all of the books that they were planning on shipping since March 28th, was the last Wednesday that they shipped books.
Right.
I was just going to say, James Tynion came out on Twitter and confirmed Batman number 92 isn't coming out till June. And he said, so we can make sure to get it to as many of you as possible on its release day. Which makes me think they're holding off because they know they can distribute to a much larger audience with Diamond.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
And to further clarify, DC is not saying like, hey, we reached out to Marvel or we reached out to Image or Dark Horse or anything. It seems very much to be limited to their product.
Right.
This is all changing very, very quickly. It could be that this fizzles out in 24 hours, just like the previous, I think it was Comic Hub thing did. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but it seems I kind of trust what DC has to say a little bit more because they have their risk and reward is much higher. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of, I would imagine, money and product built into this. They would probably want to be comfortable with their partners before they launched anything.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, they already had a relationship with Midtown Comics because of their subscription services.
Right.
This is all coming, by the way, from Newsarama.com.
Mm-hmm.
One other thing I think that's worth pointing out is that DC's canceled all the orders from April 1 to 15 that would have went to Diamond. So essentially, Diamond's lost that business.
I mean, Diamond told them they weren't going to get paid for it anyway, right?
They did say that, yeah. I think DC's doing a really good job with the messaging on this. It's very clear that they're not, you know, doing any, it's very clear what they're doing, and it's not being done because of like any vindictiveness or reactionary response. It sounds like something they might have been planning for a while, and
it's very, very measured. Yeah.
Right. Meanwhile, Marvel Comics continues to only tell folks when comics start coming out Mondays.
Yeah.
At least they're telling press this. They could be telling retailers this earlier than that. I'm not sure. But I wanted to bring this up, this bit of news, just because it seems like Marvel's making a decision day to day rather than... So I have a feeling that they are very much going to react to this DC news.
Yeah, I think DC hit some sort of tipping point that maybe Marvel hasn't hit yet.
Mm-hmm.
That DC was like, all right, well, we need to get our books out, or, you know, people want the 5G. I don't know. but that I think that, like you were just alluding to, that Marvel's response is going to be hastened by them hitting that tipping point as well.
Right. Now, let's hope that they have some similar plan, because if not, it might take them a little longer to get the books out.
I don't think they do. You know, Marvel, I don't want to get into the particulars too much. I saw people's names and people's job titles and stuff, and that made me feel a little icky.
Mm-hmm.
But they did furlough people this week as part of cost-saving measures during the coronavirus pandemic. So the two companies could not have more disparate responses.
You know, back to the reactionary comment, DC's been doing a great job. I believe it's with Batman Black and White, an anthology book, giving creators work on something that doesn't have to necessarily come out at a certain time. It can come out whenever.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that Marvel is trying to do the same thing, but... clearly maybe a little later planned than they could have been, because they, as you just said, they're furloughing people.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I want to say that it has something to do with their parent companies, because I think decisions made by these companies almost always do. Like, you can't divorce Marvel from the mouse, and you can't divorce DC from AT&T, from Warner Bros. And so I would 5G. Imagine, right. I would imagine that they have senior executives that are in those rooms or in those emails every day dictating this.
Mm-hmm.
And DC has just happened to put together a better plan this time, which is, you know, not what we're normally talking about in terms of DC.
Right.
I applaud them. I commend them. This is really, really neat. And I hope that I frankly hope that it scares Diamond a little bit.
Yeah, I would hope so. Because if you're following the news with COVID-19, this could easily come right back and fall. And if Diamond doesn't have a new plan in place, what's going to happen?
Right. And as of right now, again, this is all, we're playing it ear by ear. We're playing it all by ear.
Yeah.
Diamond is saying that they expect they're going to have books out mid-May.
At the earliest, yeah. Mid to late, they're saying, yeah.
Right.
That's their target. Yeah, that was the other big Friday news. So I guess it's a great sign that they've got some plan in place. Obviously, this plan is based on the fact that with all of us self-quarantining, by mid to late May, things will be at least moderately normal so that stores and shipping can get back on some kind of track. But
yeah,
again, they're playing it by ear. Like, for all we know, this could all blow away tomorrow.
Yeah, and I think that their response or that their timeline has probably been dictated quite a bit by them initially leading with, hey, we're not going to be paying anyone.
Right.
Backstepping to, well, we're going to pay people half and defer to, actually, books will be out in May. makes me feel like, you know, those publishers started putting pressure on them,
yes,
which is totally within their right to do,
sure.
For business to business relations and for business to consumer relations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also Diamond was like, yo, we better figure DC was like, we better figure something else out.
Right. Yeah. When I saw the DC news, I instantly thought, like, there's some guy with a spreadsheet, you know, in the accounting department. He's like, if we don't make this day, we have to start cutting this much.
Right.
It's all a numbers game at some point.
Yeah.
Speaking of numbers game, San Diego Comic-Con canceled. We were all anticipating this.
50 years.
Yes. That's crazy. That's crazy sad, too.
It is sad. This is all sad. You know, we talked about that kind of the first time we cut a show about this, but obviously my heart goes out to the people being furloughed at Marvel.
Yeah.
I care much more about that than I do about getting new issues every week, to be totally honest. Like, a little, because my backlog is huge, but you know, I care much more about that, and I care much more about, I think last week you were bringing up the economic impact,
mm-hmm.
that San Diego Comic-Con has on San Diego, on nearby vendors, and that kind of stuff, and this is going to be massive for them.
Yep.
They're not going to be able to recover, likely.
They'll need a bailout.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if they'll get a regional bailout or if extra funds will be released for something like that. My wife works for our local Chamber of Commerce, and they're working very diligently on that, making sure small businesses are paid or that they are at least reporting their losses.
Mm-hmm.
Because there may be avenues for funding through a lot of different channels in the future. And I hope that the same can be said for San Diego Comic-Con. It's also just crazy. Like, it was expected, like you said, but it's a big, hard decision to see. And it makes me wonder what publishers are going to do in terms of their announcements that they had planned.
Right. Yeah, they're going to have to do it elsewhere, virtually, I suppose.
Virtually, yeah. I think like a lot of games publishers that were going to be at E3 are also doing virtual.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. I don't know.
Marvel's going to have to step up their game when it comes to AIPT exclusive content, I think.
So you've been to a couple San Diego Comic Cons. I was, you know, it sucks. Yeah. Real quick, my soapbox real here real quick.
Yeah.
I couldn't go last year because I was sick.
Yeah.
And I can't go this year because everyone else is sick. And it sucks. So,
wait a minute. If we do it one more time, what is does the world
Everyone will be sick. Right.
Maybe, I don't know. What else? What else could be sick? The building? The building itself is sick.
So you've been a couple times. Did you have an immediate reaction? Is it something that's kind of built into your year at this point?
Yeah, this would have been my fourth year in a row. I have to say, like, it's a lot of work, really tiring. So there was a bit of a sigh of relief there. Yeah, like connecting with creators, it just feels like every year it builds more and more, you know, getting that handshake relationship going and putting a face to AIPT in any way I can is hugely helpful for the website itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, not every website can send someone or send themselves to a convention like this. So yeah, in that regard, it's a major bummer. And on top of that, you know, I'm sure San Diego will try to pull off some virtual thing, but at the same time, it's hard to get excited about stuff if you're not actually in a physical space with others getting excited about stuff.
Right, right.
Sort of like that WWE championship, what is it? WrestleMania.
WrestleMania, yes.
With zero audience.
Obviously, comics are a little bit less built on a crowd-based reaction, but I think for the convention scene, that's very true.
I'm very curious to see, it's not very comics related, but I'm very curious to see how movie studios react. Like, that was where they dropped their big, you know, Marvel Studios movie news.
Can't discount that at all. Tons of people use it as a platform for all sorts of things. And apps it was like launched there. Like, yeah.
I mean, you just said 50 years, right?
So yeah, 50.
50 years of eyeballs growing more and more anticipated for this is now gone.
Yeah.
What's going to happen now?
It didn't really necessarily feel as archaic to me as like E3 had become. Mm-hmm. You know, Sony had been dropped out of E3 for like 2 years at this point. Video games are an inherently digital medium anyway. Comics aren't.
No.
The people that buy physical comics or the people that want to go to a physical comics convention tend to be a totally different crowd than the digital buyers. Mm-hmm. Not saying that people that buy digital aren't also invested in the SDCC announcements, but it's a totally different culture. And the impact on them, yourself included, is not negligible.
Yeah, we'll see. I think, to my best recollection, the next con that would be coming up is Fan Expo in Boston, which is, I think, in August.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And then, obviously, NYCC is the big con.
And Emerald City is tentatively rescheduled for August.
Oh, that's true. NYCC is usually October.
I'm probably not going to go to that, to be honest.
Yeah, even if they are able to open and say the world isn't so sick, I have a feeling a good chunk of people aren't going to want to be, you know, put into a giant space with other thousands of people.
Yeah.
In other news, though, and it's a positive one, don't worry, Vault Comics has announced their new series Giga by Alex Paknadel and John Lay. This is coming out in July 2020, so this year, folks. I don't know if you've checked out the preview on AIPTComics.com, but it's got a Transformers vibe?
Yeah, like a Transformers meets Gundam kind of vibe. Post-apocalyptic, I think it is. Alex Paknadel had said, "Our book depicts a world in which the robots destroyed every metropolitan center on Earth.
Bastards.
Instantly rendering a good chunk of the human race homeless. Then when their war inexplicably and abruptly ended, they went dormant for so long that humanity moved in." Which is very neat. You often don't see the aftermath of like kaiju stories, big robot stories, that kind of stuff. So I love the idea of exploring a world like that.
Vault is on a roll, man. I don't see them dropping anytime soon.
Vault is the new Image.
There you go.
And that they have this kind of indie lineup right now that just feels untouchable. They've all been good.
If Vault is the new Image, is TKO the new Top Cow?
I think TKO is the new... there's not really a TKO.
Yeah, it's all... Yeah, it's kind of release the whole thing. They don't use Diamond.
Yeah. TKO is kind of the new Comixology Originals, maybe.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I like that. Or HBO. TKO is the new HBO. It's not comics. It's TKO. Oh, my God. Somebody copyright that. They should use that.
But it looks very, very good. I've not been disappointed by a Vault series.
For sure. Boom is also killing it lately, and they've killed it with
binge Netflix. Watching.
There you go. Netflix and Boom have made a deal. Netflix is going to get a first look deal with Boom Studios titles. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of creators like James Tynion on Twitter excited about this, because obviously his work can now be turned into a TV show on Netflix. It's got kind of a fast track rather than a long curve track to, you know, movie pitch hell or TV pitch hell.
Right, yeah.
It's worth noting they have 20 properties already in development with Fox, including Mimetic with Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg producing.
Hmm.
That's the comic came out 5 years ago.
You with about, the sloth, yeah.
Yes, the sloth in the phone that makes everyone crazy. But yeah, so yeah, Boom is looking more and more up for 2020. Okay, and our next bit of news. This is maybe a little older, so maybe not as, you know, well-timed in our show here, but Todd McFarlane is calling for unity across publishers to combat the coronavirus comics downturn. In his interview with Forbes, he basically pointed out that all the retailers should give away a bunch of their books that they were planning on putting out, because in his words, paraphrasing, you got to give the nerds what they want so they keep their interest up. Kind of an interesting take. Obviously, with the news with DC moving forward in just 2 weeks to start shipping stuff, this is not as necessary of a plan. But I thought it was worth mentioning that this guy who's obviously hugely successful had an idea. And maybe is that a smart idea to just put out a couple books for free?
Yes. I mean, quite a few publishers have put out number ones for free. So it's not a new idea necessarily. But that's, I think, true. It is a good idea. And I think it's a good idea for names as big as Todd McFarlane to be promoting the industry in that way. Yeah. Todd McFarlane is the anti. I can't even remember the guy's name.
Who's Rob Liefeld?
Rob Liefeld. Thank you. Man. Wow.
I read your mind.
I blocked him on Twitter and it seemingly erased him from my mind.
That's funny.
He is the anti-Rob Liefeld, and that he really cares about the industry and he really cares about people succeeding. And that's very, very cool.
But he's still a businessman like Rob Liefeld. Yeah,
true.
In our next bit of news, new writer-artist takes over at IDW Sonic the Hedgehog comic book, but without saying when, because of coronavirus.
Yeah, weird choice.
It was an interesting reveal. Obviously, maybe it was something to do with when they signed the contract. They were allowed to, I don't know. But the artist, Evan Stanley, will be taking over as writer and artist on the book. It sounds like IDW might be blowing up the Sonic franchise comics.
Yeah, they're doing a spin-off miniseries called Sonic and Bad Guys also.
What a great title.
Tells you everything you need to know. It's all on the label.
But obviously this is a reaction to the movie that ended up doing fairly well comparatively to all our anticipation and expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Next bit of news. Jim Lee is doing 60 sketches for 60 days. To generate funds for the Book Industry Charitable Foundation, which all the proceeds, or most of the proceeds, go to comic book shops that are in need, that are struggling, that are closing. At the time, I think on Thursday, I think, they had raised over $100,000.
That's crazy. That's crazy. Yeah.
So if you go to APT Comics, we have a nice little article of the first 12 sketches, mm-hmm. which it's kind of a neat idea. So you get to choose the sketch. If you pay for, so the first person who paid for the sketch or won the sketch, sorry, because they're just being sold on eBay, gets the sketch, obviously, but then also gets to choose what the next character he'll draw. And obviously it has to be DC related or DC owned. And there's some beautiful sketches here. A lot of Batman centric characters like Azrael and Batman Who Laughs.
And the Arkham Knight, I think I saw.
Yep, and Grim Knight. Yep, Grim Knight.
Yep.
So if you tune to AIPTcomics.com on Sunday, we will have the exclusive look at the 19th sketch. the first time it'll ever enter the interwebs.
He is good at marketing.
Yeah.
It reminds me, is this in partnership with the Creators for Comics thing or not?
It is the same charitable cause.
Okay, yeah. Awesome. Well, it is the perfect segue into talking about Creators for Comics, which is a coalition of creators who have teamed up to organize an auction to benefit the BINC Foundation, the Book Industry Charitable Foundation. which is a charity for comic shops and indie bookstores. Brian Michael Bendis, Donny Cates, Tom King, Tom Taylor, Jody Hauser, plenty of other comics creators are offering auctions for either written goods, drawn goods, original comics art covers, signed copies, collections, even like Zoom meetings with them in the case of like Carlo Pacheco. That's all really, really cool. And the proceeds are going directly to the industry that we all love.
Scott Snyder was offering 3 classes on how to write comics. The first issue of a comic. That was kind of neat. You know, it was interesting. I also saw, I contemplated it, by the way. I saw Jason Aaron said, I don't do podcasts. I will do your podcast if you're the high bidder.
That's pretty
then
cool.
Then I scrolled into the replies and it was like up to $600.
Yeah, I did see Tyler Crook, who is one of my favorite artists, did a Black Hammer piece. And it was up to $700 in like an hour.
It was wild seeing people bid in the Twitterverse.
Yes, it is strange.
Some people don't even scroll through the replies and see what the high bid is. They just go 200. And then like I saw Jason Aaron being like 200 was already listed.
And also like it is weird to put yourself out in social media like that and be like, this is how much money I have.
That's true.
You know, in a way that's interesting. Yeah. I think that they do have another channel for that kind of stuff, but it's interesting.
Right. It is interesting. Yeah. But yeah, it was quite cool to see. I mean, gosh, almost every creator I can think of was doing something.
Yeah, absolutely. All of them. Pretty much, I follow pretty much only comics people, and pretty much only comics people follow me. And it's my entire feed. It's very, very cool. And I wanted to make sure we highlighted it.
For sure. Yeah. And just another point on Jim Lee, other people are using his eBay store to sell works of art, like Brian Hitch had a sketch, and those are all, of course, still going to the same cause. I'd love to know what their total is if they, but I don't know if they'd have to. No, as a charity, they have to release that number, right?
Yeah, and I don't think they would be opposed to doing so anyway.
But yeah, if you come back on Sunday, you get to see his 19th sketch here first. In our next bit of news, Ed Brubaker, Marcos Martin, and Munsta Vicente all have something in common. They're coming out with a post-YA horror series called Friday, which is already out online on Panel Syndicate. If you're not familiar, Panel Syndicate is a pretty cool comic book store of sorts where you get to name your price for the comic. Usually they suggest like $2 or $3, but you can literally put $0 and still get the comic.
Yeah, the other common storefront folks might be familiar with is Gumroad. Has a lot of name your own pricing stuff. It's similar to that.
It's cool that they've got this coming out. I wonder if they were planning on it or if they kind of rushed to get it up a little earlier. I know some publishers have tried to move stuff that is digital only to this month since there are no physical books.
Do you remember the first thing that you paid what you want for?
It probably was something on Panel Syndicate, actually. I think it was one of the first Panel Syndicate comics, which was Brian K. Vaughan and Marcos Martin, I think.
Okay.
I forget.
I didn't realize Marcos Martin went back that far. That's cool. I remember mine was Radiohead's In Rainbows.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
That was a big deal. They bought newspaper ads, or the album, the company bought newspaper ads and stuff that was like, buy Radiohead's album, pay what you want.
Okay, that's it for news. Good job, buddy.
Oh, thank you.
You just got through the news. You're welcome.
Sometimes it's very daunting. Right now it is very daunting.
Every week we've got to swallow our pride and get through the hard news. Next up, AIPT Book Club. We're going to be talking about Black Hammer Justice League, Hammer of Justice, the 5-issue series by Jeff Lemire and Michael Walsh. So, Forrest, to start this segment, we always talk about the story so far.
Yes.
Want to fill us in?
Yeah, so the setup for this one is actually very simple. It's very similar to a lot of other crossover comics folks may have read, which is that we see the cast of Black Hammer, in particular the cast of Black Hammer Age of Doom, Abraham Slam, Colonel Weird, Barbalian, Gale, all of those characters on the farm in Rockwood. And then we also see the Justice League, and they're fighting Starro. And at the same time, in parallel worlds, or opposite dimensions, a stranger in a red suit and a bowling hat appears. He says some weird, prophetic, tricky stuff, double meaning, dualism, parallelism stuff. And then all of a sudden, the Justice League are in the Black Hammer universe, and the Black Hammer characters are in the Justice League universe, in the DC universe. And it kind of explores what makes those universes different, what makes those characters. Obviously, a lot of Black Hammer characters are pastiches of, in particular, DC characters. In that, like, Barbalian is Martian Manhunter send up, and that kind of stuff. So it explores those sorts of things. It also explores, like, how magic works differently. Gale meets Zatanna, and they try some magic, that kind of stuff. And it explores those things in different universes. It plays around with timelines and canon quite a bit. This was actually released, I think, following the reveal of what had happened in Black Hammer, how they had gotten to the farm in Black Hammer, and kind of that big mystery that they had been unraveling in the Black Hammer universe for quite some time. But this is, I want to point out, distinctly different. So it takes the initial Black Hammer idea and runs with it, but they never actually spoil Black Hammer, and similarly, although it's more difficult to, they never spoil what's going on with the Justice League either, which is very nice. I appreciated that very much. And it kind of explores both of these different groups trying to come to terms with what had happened to them, and then also get back or not back to the appropriate worlds and universes, in that the Justice League believes that they have been on the farm for 10 years, just like the Black Hammer characters actually have been in that continuity.
They actually have been on the farm for 10 years?
They have been, yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And we should maybe approach or talk about where we're approaching the series from. So Black Hammer is one of my favorite indie stories of the last decade, maybe. I tend to read all of the spinoff series. I really love, like, Skeleton Boy and Skulldigger. I've read a lot of Age of Doom. I have the first three volumes in hardcover. So I was very familiar with that universe. I was very familiar with those characters. To the point that I was like, well, this isn't canon. And one character says a line that it addresses that it's not canon, but you wouldn't know so unless you already had been reading Black Hammer. So I thought that was very well done. And then, obviously the Justice League characters are so ubiquitous that you kind of already know who they are.
I've only dipped my baby toe into the Black Hammer universe just when it started. I ended up just not reading it, and then years go by, and then I'm like, oh god, I haven't read any of it. I have been reading Skeleton Boy though, and I've loved it. At the same time, that is very accessible and not necessarily connected to these other characters. It's just in the same universe, right? So I'm coming from a different angle entirely, which might be many other people's perspective, which is I didn't necessarily know these characters. I knew of the universe, but I didn't know anything about it. So this was like a really good primer to dive into these characters, and which I can get into in a bit when we talk about what's good.
Yeah. Conceptually, a little bit of the history is that this was announced in March 2019 by Dark Horse and DC. I think that they even co-published it. And it is written by Jeff Lemire, drawn by Michael Walsh. Lemire had assured readers he was going to keep Black Hammer character driven. They weren't going to rely on endless tie-ins and events. It's not a throwaway imaginary story either. It will have lasting repercussions on future Black Hammer stories. They've often been referring to the farm plot as kind of the first phase of the Black Hammer universe. So I think that they may carry this through. That's obviously something we can talk about in the sequel portion of our little book club here. and then when discussing whether there could be further crossovers in the future, Lemire had said, this is a very good opportunity for a story to be told. I'm open to it, but I doubt we'll see many or any other crossovers in the future. This worked really well and is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to tell a really great story. And that's based off the fact that DC had reached out to Dark Horse and asked them, not that Lemire had kind of generated the pitch on his own.
Right. Yeah. Which is surprising.
And I think what he's alluding to is that there may be more DC crossovers, but that at this point in time, it doesn't make sense to cross over the DC or the Black Hammer universe with, say, like, other superhero universes. I can't even think of Marvel, I guess.
Sonic.
Yeah. Sonic bad guys.
There you go.
That he's not interested in that, but that DC presented a unique opportunity to do so. And I think that that's because the Black Hammer, the main group of characters in Black Hammer, is such a good send-up of the Justice League anyway.
Right, right, right. Which they kind of, yeah, which you referenced before, they kind of refer to a couple times. Yeah. With a little wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah, so over the course of the five issues, it reads very quickly. They explore exactly who the stranger is that has crossed their universes, what they want. There's very good detective work on both sides of the story as well. We won't spoil who the culprit is or where that's going from here, but it definitely feels very natural and very well told. I have to imagine that when they pitched this to Lemire, he was like, I got an idea. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very honed five issues.
Yes, absolutely. There's no fat at all.
Right. So can we get into what works?
Absolutely. For my part, I do want to lead with, I loved this. I already love Black Hammer, so it's a little painted by that. But I did immediately order the hardcover after reading it.
Nice.
Yeah.
So since I wasn't as familiar with these characters, this felt like a really great lead into Black Hammer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If anything, this was more of a Black Hammer book than it was a Justice League book.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
Because, I mean, and that, I think largely that might be because we already know Justice League, whereas obviously Black Hammer isn't as familiar to readers. So there's a little more work to be done to flesh them out. Whereas there's a lot of scenes with the Justice League characters where they're, you know, we know who Superman is. I mean, we do get a little backstory of him on a page where we see him fighting crime, but there isn't a lot of work needed to be done to explain why Flash can run quickly or anything, you know?
Right.
Whereas the Black Hammer characters,
boy,
we have to kind of...
good.
What is happening? I've never heard
oh
of this character.
Oh, my God.
Do you ever watch the CW? They should make a show about it. But I think the beauty of this series for me was like really getting the character dynamics and the character wrinkles through so well. So like I want to read more of it. I want to read more about each one of these characters and know what happened before and if they're continuing on or if they're gone.
Yeah, I think that it works really well as a hook for the Black Hammer universe. I think he wrote it very specifically to not spoil what was happening in Black Hammer at the same time. This is almost like a pocket universe.
Right.
But it works very well, and I think you could pick up Black Hammer and start reading it from here. I also especially love that he said it is going to have an impact, as far as he can control, on Black Hammer. I think it would be cool if it did on the Justice League, too, but that's obviously a little more tenuous.
Difficult? Because DC's constantly changing their stories?
Right, yeah.
For all we know, all these characters will be gone when 5G finally comes and blows us all away, and we're like, why didn't they do this when they did New 52?
Yeah.
Also, the art, fantastic.
It's amazing. Michael Walsh.
It's not your conventional superhero art style.
No.
But it works so well.
Yeah. I think
there's a weight to the characters.
It's very grounded by Dave Stewart's colors, too. Mm-hmm. Dave Stewart is the typical colorist for Black Hammer. And so the way that it feels like it's all kind of in that world works very, very well for the narrative.
The story doesn't... Gosh, I'm trying to think of how to describe the visuals. I don't know. You know, the Black Hammer characters are very much like entrenched in reality, whereas Justice League, obviously, they're like gods. So that blending of the two kind of works in this. I mean, we get literally like gods that are taller than skyscrapers showing up or giant freaky whales.
Yeah.
And Starro himself is rendered really creepily, like almost each one of his little arms is like, not little, but each one of his arms is like muscular and kind of, you know, like flexing.
Yeah.
Whereas we sometimes see him where he's like just flat, you know, just like this weird shape. Whereas here he's got this texture to him that again enriches the book as like this real thing and it makes it even more creepy. Yeah, the visuals are just stunning.
I think you've called out pretty much everything that I liked about it. I think for me, it made me realize that I don't really like where the Justice League is at currently. I reading this, I was like, this is a great Justice League story, you know, and like, as compared to what's happening right now, I'm not so interested in DC's normal continuity, whatever that may be.
Right.
It made me like that a lot. The characters are all very well characterized. I also like that it explicitly calls out that they are normally different publishers.
Right. I love the swearing.
There's a recurring joke about swearing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that even it like kind of bleeds over to a later issue where the Flash swears and the Green Lantern is like, it's not like you to swear. thought that that right. was really funny, and I'm glad that there was something on the nose about it that I appreciated.
Yeah, it's like there are rules to these universes that you can or cannot get away with swearing or whatever, or violence or something.
Yeah,
it's kind of an interesting little twist. Was there anything you didn't like about the book?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a double-edged sword in that you're right that it does feel very much about Black Hammer. But it feels like it's not necessarily about the Black Hammer that we know. And that's something that he can't really control, and that he doesn't want to give up the goat with Black Hammer because that would make it not worth reading, right? Which I think that this series is intended to do, but it is kind of outside of the canon of both universes. And as of right now, there's just Jeff's word on that it will matter to Black Hammer. But you kind of feel like, all right, well, that was a little fun and done. Especially because it's short. I think if it had been 12 issues or even 10 issues, I would have felt a little more invested in this particular arc. But it is so short and so lean that there's not a lot of room to explore what DC is going to look like or what Black Hammer is going to look like after this. Except for a great stinger at the end.
I really can't imagine how the Black Hammer universe would be affected by this, because it is like a hard day in the DC universe, and then they're right back to where they were before, right? My main issue with this book is that it feels like the first act of a 3-act story. Because it does a great job of flipping these characters' lives so that they're in each other's universes, and then seeing them react. And a large part of the Black Hammer part of the story is really just them trying to explain to the rest of the Justice League characters who didn't get flipped into the Black Hammer universe who they are. So it felt very much like the first 20 minutes of a show, you know, instead of the full episode. I wanted to see it go a little bit further with the cliffhanger, which is why I'm so shocked that Lemire said that they wouldn't be making another one of these anytime soon, because it feels like it's very much sets up like a great second crossover, especially with when you consider other crossovers at other publishers. And DC did the same thing with Dynamite when they did it with who's that guy, the Shadow?
Yes, yeah.
Like DC publishes it, right, and then Batman and Shadow team up, and then Dynamite gets to do theirs, and then they have Batman and Shadow. Yeah. I was thinking they were going to flip it, like, because this feels very much more like a Dark Horse book than a DC book. Mm-hmm. I was thinking DC would then get to use the Black Hammer characters as they see fit or whatever, of course, with Lemire's blessing. But I guess that's not happening. So I ended the book and I was like, that's it?
Yeah.
Like, a little bit more, please. But that's all I really wanted.
I think
wanted.
That's a good problem to have, ultimately.
It is. Yeah,
but right. I did feel that way, too.
Also, like, I've already said this, but the Justice League characters are kind of just there, in my opinion, whereas the Black Hammer characters are more interesting, and Batman is just like brooding and wants to really fight people.
Yeah, there's a there are other DC characters in it that aren't the Justice League that are better explored. Zatanna, Green Lantern, Martian Manhunter,
fair, yeah.
Those kinds of folks that actually work very well in their universe. But they do just kind of pan over to the Justice League in the Black Hammer universe and say, yeah, their fish is out of water. Weird.
Yeah.
That's true. Even though they're
sure
written...
sucks, we've been here for 10 years.
Right. even though they're written pitch perfectly. I did... And this is funny because it comes up in the book itself, but I did kind of forget that Cyborg was a member of the Justice League. So it suddenly cut to a page of Cyborg, and I was like, oh, what's he doing?
Yeah, because it actually... No, I think you're onto something, because when he showed up, I was also... I mean, I knew he was in the Justice League, but like... It seemed like he was sort of inserted later.
Yeah.
So did you have a favorite artistic moment?
Yeah, absolutely. Very early on, I think it's in the first issue, the Stranger is standing in the direct center of the page, and the panels split him. They vivisect him right down the center, and you get kind of the Black Hammer universe on one side and the Justice League universe on the other side. And it shows you how these characters match up, and both sides are artistically different. And there's a little bit of art and panel work indicating that they are bleeding into each other or swapping. I thought that was very, very cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love the weird stuff in this. I love the giant whales when Flash swears.
Yes.
floating about, yeah. And they swallow up the spaceman guy. What's his name?
Colonel Weird. Yeah.
There you go.
Okay. I was like, there's also Green Lantern. You know who Green Lantern is, right? Yeah. Colonel Weird.
Who's the Electric Man? Yeah. Oh, that's Flash.
And the Parazone, in that extent, is very, very cool. Very Kirby-esque.
Yeah. And I also love when the whale swallows the spaceman. There's a written out gulp.
Yeah.
It's just I don't know, little details like that get me. The teeth are wild on that thing, too. Damn.
Yeah, that thing was very cool.
Moving on to favorite narrative moment. I loved the Martian thing going on.
Yeah.
Between the green and red Martians and how, what are you, crazy? Martians are red. Like, I love that throughout. And there was a great moment when, what's the Martian guy's name?
Barbalian.
Sorry. He is being interrogated and he turns into Martian Manhunter.
Yeah.
And he's like, look at me. I'm a little green man. I thought that was hilarious and just felt so fitting considering like the ramifications of what's happening, the fact that they're in prison, but they could escape at any moment. That was just well done.
Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite narrative moment?
My favorite narrative moment is also, we should say that's the opening of the third issue. Hawkwoman, Martian Manhunter, Aquaman, they're all interviewing the Black Hammer characters about what they did with the Justice League. And that whole thing is like amazing characterization very quickly. I'm talking like one panel per character. And it's also very, very funny. I loved like Aquaman is like, you really expect me to believe you all came from a farm? Who are you working for? Luther? Brainiac? It's not Vandal Savage again, is it? And it cuts to Barbalian on the next panel going, what's a Brainiac? They keep kind of going like that. And Gail's whole bit, of course, is that she looks like a 10-year-old, but is actually in her 60s. Not a lot of people know that. There would be no reason for the people in the Justice League universe to believe that. And Aquaman has a scene where he's got his head in his palm, and he says, stop looking at me like that. And it cuts to Gail. She's winking at him, and she says, you go ahead and play hard to get, Fishman. I like it.
I gotta say, that is edgy. You'd never see that in a movie, I don't think.
No. But it was a good
example of comics.
And then later,
awesome.
Gail is great throughout this. She's a detestable character. She is in Black Hammer too, but also her struggle is very realistic and understandable. There's a part later on where her and Wonder Woman are punching some monsters side by side, doing kind of an uppercut up the panel, and they both compliment each other on each other's style and say that they're bitching, which I thought was really funny. Probably my favorite moment in the entire series, though, is the very end when the antagonist is fading into space, having just kind of revealed his trump card. And it's like equal parts funny and cosmic and like, oh, Justice League, the villain lives again. And also just like grotesque and horrifying because it's just like his flesh and eyeballs in the void of space. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really, really well done. Kind of marrying the silliness, the high fantasy of the Justice League universe with the horror of the Black Hammer universe.
Nice.
That was really, really cool. Difficult to talk about without spoiling, but very cool.
Oh, you did a good job. I wasn't spoiled.
I was thinking about it this whole time.
So Lemire's already kind of ruined our next part of the segment, but where do we think this is going?
Like I said, the first phase of the Black Hammer universe is over. And there's not a lot of direction after that. The farm stuff is over. So I don't know if he's using this as kind of a linchpin to tell a much bigger story in that universe.
Did the other characters
not.
Know? Sorry.
Go ahead.
Did the other characters know the little girl was 60?
What other characters?
The other Black Hammer characters?
Yes, they all know
they
that.
They did know.
Yeah, they were literally like a Justice League team in the Black Hammer universe before they got to the farm.
And they've seen her old.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
I'm just trying to think, like, was there something revealed that was new to them?
I mean, the existence of another dimension, I guess.
There you go. That could be. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. There's a part where Dragonfly, the magical character in Black Hammer, is talking to the villain in this series, the Stranger. And they both allude to knowing that there's much, much more than this.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically have a meta conversation about, like, well, this isn't canon, is it? And that was very well done, and I could see Lemire leaning on that aspect, especially knowing what his predilections are in terms of, like, Gideon Falls and stuff, meta-narrative. Mm-hmm. So, I think, at the very least, there will be one character that remembers this in Black Hammer. And if that defines their motivations, that would be very cool.
What happens if the Black Hammer TV show ends up becoming a movie series, ends up becoming bigger than the Justice League movies? What happens then? Does Jeff Lemire save the Justice League by integrating the Justice League into his Black Hammer movie universe?
Yeah, so I guess outside of fiction, what this made me want more than anything is for Jeff Lemire to write Batman. And he had even said in an interview, my favorite character to write was Batman, just because I haven't gotten to spend a lot of time with him. I think I called him months back as being the next Batman writer before it was Tinian. And I'm still in love with that idea.
I'm sure he'll get around to it. He's not going anywhere.
He strikes me as a writer who thinks about his projects and commits to the things that he wants to do. Mm-hmm. And he's also been afforded the ability to do so through writing really, really great comics industry-wide.
Well, he might come up with 6G, we don't know, in 15 years.
Was there anything that struck you as being particularly sequel-y?
Well, aside from the fact that this felt like a first act of
a three-act story. Right, yeah. I mean, it ends on a cliffhanger. We can't ignore that.
Yeah, you know, if you just look at this as a great way to be introduced to the characters and be inspired to go back and read all the Dark Horse books, I think you don't need anything else. This is good. This is a good ending.
Mm-hmm.
But aside from that, no, there isn't much there besides the big cliffhanger in this story.
Right.
But, I mean, not to spoil it, but that character is used in this fashion quite a bit, where it's like anything goes, then they, boop, they're gone.
Yeah.
So when the cliffhanger happened, I actually was thinking to other DC stories where this character was used, even in, I'm not going to say, in another story that we read recently, there's a character that's similar to this. And again, it's a kind of a one-off fun little character that writers like to use briefly, but never you don't see a magnum opus.
It's impossible. Yeah. I think there's very few writers I would want writing that.
Could you imagine if they had their
Although Lemire is very, very good for it, I will say. And I have to imagine that when DC and Dark Horse came to terms on it, that Lemire had already been like, all right, it's written. Got it.
Right.
You know.
But this was a good pick.
I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. I liked it more than I thought I was going to.
I wasn't sure what to expect. I think I went in with low expectations just because crossovers tend to stink.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I think crossovers tend to do what this issue does in the first, what this miniseries does in the first issue, and then not much more novel than that. But the idea, Lemire really, I think, sat down and thought about the practicality, in that he was like, the magic would work different in the DC universe, so why not? Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And it's the commentary on the characters we know that's really enjoyable too.
Yeah.
You could tell Lemire's a fan just like us, and if we were given the opportunity, we would have someone poke, you know, Aquaman or Batman in a funny way. Right. All right. Well, that is the third. Is that the third book club
we've done? That is the third. Yeah. I think we're getting better at this.
I think we're offhand
what we're going to be reading next week.
Jeez Louise, I don't know. My ideas right now are impossible to read in a week.
Yeah.
I'd love to do Sandman or Swamp Thing.
I was all new Wolverine. Oh, it's 6 volumes? Never mind.
Yeah. Right. I wouldn't mind doing maybe the first arc of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing.
And that would be fantastic. I would love to revisit that. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's one of the greatest romance comics of all time. Yep. It's obviously incredibly important.
Yeah.
To the comics medium today, because so many of us, when we were little, were reading it. So that might be my pick, if you're game.
Yeah, totally. I think I would love to do Batman Year One at some point. But definitely, if folks have suggestions, feel free to tweet them to us, too.
Hell yeah, we'll do our research. In our next segment, we will be having Mark Russell on to talk about his latest comics, his upcoming Marvel work, Captain America, that he's working with Kurt Busiek with, and much, much more.
Like and subscribe. Thanks. Bye. Hi, Mark.
On with us is Mark Russell. He's recently done Billionaire Island, Captain America Marvel Snapshot coming soon. You know him from Flintstones, you know him from Wonder Twins, and you know him from Second Coming. Thank you so much for being on the show, Mark.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, Mark, I want to start right off the bat with Captain America Marvel Spotlight. I know it's not out yet. I know it was supposed to come out, which is a total bummer because I was so excited for it. I've loved what Kurt Busiek's done with the other books that have come out in this curated series. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about how that project got off the ground with Kurt Busiek?
Yeah, well, it started when he sent me an email saying that he was doing this Snapshot series, and somebody, I don't know who, had told him that I was somebody they should look up. And I'm glad they did. I'm glad they recommended me because, it was a good experience. I'm really happy to have done this, the story with him. And if you want to learn how to write a comic book, working on one with Kurt Busiek is a pretty good way to learn. I thought I knew what I was doing before, but it wasn't until I was working with him, I realized, oh, wow, this guy actually knows how to make a comic book. And he thinks about things that I had never even crossed my mind in making comic books before.
That's interesting. Since he was curating, did he hand you like a packet of Captain America stories he wanted you to read or anything like that?
Yeah, sort of. He said that it was obviously going to be an extension of the Mad Bomb story that ran in 1975 to 1976. So I went and read the entire, Mad Bomb Jack Kirby story. And that was pretty much it. That was my prep work in terms of like the continuity that it was going to be fit in. He also gave me some like really valuable tips about like what was going on with the rest of the superheroes in that universe in 1975. So I could work that in. And also sort of the vagaries of what AIM would have looked like. He's very meticulous what the AIM headquarters would have looked like in 1975 and what, the Kirby Tech would have been like back then. So his involvement and his coaching really makes it feel a lot more seamlessly fitting into its time and place. I mostly wanted to write a story set in mid-70s, the Bronx, which was falling apart as New York City was going bankrupt, and to sort of like blame it a little bit on, or use the Mad Bomb really as a metaphor for what happened to our urban cities during our urban centers during the 70s, and how we just sort of abandoned people and let these urban centers decay while leaving people to fend for themselves inside them. I wanted that to be the aftermath of the Mad Bomb and to really tell that story of people forgotten. When our country recovers from like a calamity, the people who are left behind, I wanted to tell that story using the Mad Bomb as a template.
Wow. The story sounds like it's really well timed.
Yeah, no, it's weird. The more you write about calamities, the more timely they seem to be.
So since we can't actually see the book yet, can you talk a little bit about what Ramon Perez is doing with the art and how you guys agreed on the visual style for that book?
Yeah, well, it helped that we had this sort of touchstone to begin with in the Kirby Mad Bomb series. So a lot of the look was really just sort of an homage to the Kirby Tech and the look of his mid-70s comics, the costumes, like Captain America and Falcon are all kind of like based on the Kirby work in the mid-70s. So that determined a lot of the look for us. But more than that, I also sent Ramon like a lot of pictures of like actual photographs of what the South Bronx looked like in the mid-70s when buildings are being burned out for their insurance money, and how it was just like it looked like a war zone where there hadn't been a war. Where there's just rubble, piles of rubble in the middle of like the city and emptied out buildings and burned out buildings, like as if it had been bombed, and people just living amidst these ruins. And so I gave a lot of those photographs to him so he can imbue that sense of sort of quiet resolve in the midst of desperation in his artwork. And his artwork just looks beautiful to me, even though it is like largely telling the story of desolation.
Yeah, the series is very much steeped in reality, especially considering superhero stories. I have to ask, how are things going with comics currently on hold for you? Are you working on anything? Is it pencils down for you?
I had a couple of things that were pencils down, but, you know, things that were sort of wrapping up anyway, or things that were, they asked me if I could take a delayed payment where I get paid once the comic actually comes out. So I've actually been quite lucky not really to lose much work during these times, because I'm still working on, Billionaire Island is still in production. Second Coming, which is my other comic with Ahoy, I'm still working on that, still working on the Red Sonja series for Dynamite, and doing some of the Giants for DC. So the work really hasn't stopped, even though the comics industry is sort of in an uncertain juncture right now, which I'm really grateful for. It could have been much worse for me, and I realize that it is much worse for a lot of creators working out there.
Yeah, it's tough, and it seems like the news is changing every day. Even today, new news came out from DC that they're going to be publishing no matter what by the end of the month. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. I'm glad. I hope other companies take their lead and realize that this is just a chance to sort of, and I hope the whole country realizes that this is a chance to sort of pivot, to change the way we do things, to make ourselves less vulnerable in the future.
Speaking of changing the way you do things, I loved your DC Year of the Villain one-shots because they so much did like the opposite of what many of the other one-shots did. For instance, like Riddler didn't actually get powered up by Lex, or the Sinestro story felt like it was a total, you know, a story on its own in the sci-fi realm. And then Harley Quinn, of course, with the award show setup. I want to ask, when you were developing these great one-shots, did you pitch all three at the time? Were there other pitches that you gave DC that may not have gotten picked up?
Actually, it was kind of the opposite. They pitched these to me. Doing the Year of the Villain. And so they're like, and they didn't pitch the story, they pitched the characters.
Okay.
They're like, we want you to write a Sinestro story. We want you to write an award ceremony starring with Harley Quinn as the MC. And then it was up to me to sort of build the story based upon these premises. And I think that's why they come across as sort of like a complete story, because I wasn't really approached like in terms of like, we need something to fit this, you know, slot in the continuity that's only going to make sense if people have read these, you know, 10 other issues. Mm-hmm. They just approached me about doing a story, one and done with this character in this movement. And I think that, to me as a reader, those are always kind of the ones I always gravitate to more anyway, because I don't like necessarily reading a comic unless I'm really into that series that requires me to have had read others that with, you know, in order to get payoff. Right. I want to be able to like just pick something up at random. And even if it is part of a continuity, even if it is part of a larger story arc, to feel like I had a complete reading experience there while sitting there with that one floppy comic book. And that's kind of the way I approached writing these one-offs. And luckily I didn't know any better. I didn't know I was supposed to be doing anything differently, because they just approached me about these different characters, these different stories, with, you know, the one sort of caveat that like, oh, Sinestro has to report back to Apex Lex, or Apex Lex has to sort of appear in all of them. I had them sort of like appear in very minor roles in most of them, but in not such a way that would stop me from telling the story that I wanted to tell.
See, I pictured you with like a lip ring, tattoos, and you were like part of the Rat Pack, and you were like, look, DC, I want to do these crazy offbeat stories. I'm going to rock the world. It's just funny. Sorry, I had to make that joke.
Well, luckily, you know, DC is very tolerant of the fact that I don't know what I'm doing. So they give me a character, and this is usually the way my run with my career with DC has worked. They give me a character and then they just sort of let me go. And then I come back and I give them something and then they're like, this is never going to work, or, oh, we need it to have this change or something. But it's very much, you know, me asking for forgiveness rather than permission.
Nice.
And so far I've gotten the forgiveness. So, and I think it works well for the storytelling.
It certainly does.
So to switch gears a little bit, you also mentioned your new upcoming, still upcoming project, Billionaire Island. And it seems like every day we're learning about the U.S. government enriching the rich, helping them with back-channel bills and all that stuff. It makes Billionaire Island seem more important and poignant. Can you tell us a little bit about the series' creation and whether or not the current pandemic is inspiring you to change it as you script future issues? I know the first issue is out.
Yeah, actually, the and almost all the artwork is done. Steve is like halfway through issue number 6 right now. Oh, so wow. I couldn't change anything if I wanted to, really.
Okay.
But I don't want to. I mean, I feel like, and if anything, it's the pandemic has only made it more timely. It's only sort of illustrated what I was talking about, like how the billionaires, as comic book readers, we've been taught to believe that the billionaires are our friends, that they're going to bail us out, like Bruce Wayne would use his fortune to clean up the streets, or you know, Tony Stark would use his fortune to protect the planet from existential threats. Whereas in reality, it's just much more cost effective for them to use their fortunes to build themselves like an escape island, to build themselves a yacht, their own little sort of Goldfinger mini shuttle to break off from the rest of the human race and fly to safety as the rest of us are left to drown. And you see that now. You see that even with the stimulus and the bailout, mm-hmm. like more than half of it. And this is money which, you know, we really only get one shot at this because it's a ton of money. And most of it is going to, you know, companies that are still laying off thousands of people, like I read somewhere, I forget which airline, I don't want to besmirch anyone's honor, but it was some airline.
All of them.
Probably all of them. They took the bailout money, and then they, like the next week, they laid off like, you know, 11,000 employees.
Jeez.
So it really is about how our, what we imagined our social safety net, what we imagined the benefits of civilization that were supposed to be for us all, have really just kind of been co-opted by this sort of top 1%. And they realize, even if they won't tell us this, they realize that the party's coming to an end and they need somewhere quiet to wait out the end of the world mm-hmm. while the rest mm-hmm. of us sort of fight over the scraps.
Did you?
It really harkens to, I'm sorry if I'm just ramble on a little
no,
more.
No, it's okay. Go ahead.
It's really about how, There's a price to be paid for the fact that we have allowed, we have created all these problems for the planet by pulling all of its natural resources out and burning all of its fuel within a very short period of human history, and not using any of the resources created by that to fix the problems that are created by that. So mm-hmm. it's like none of the world's resources are going to solve the world's problems, and that will be a major calamity for the rest of us within my lifetime, I believe.
Forrest, you're going to ask something else?
I was, real quick. Did you do any research or see anything about the, I think they call it like Silicon Valley 2 in New Zealand? Like Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, they all have bunkers that are all like a mile apart.
Oh, really? I didn't know
that. It's sort of what inspired a lot of the writing was like, I started reading all these stories about like bug out bunkers and like, mm-hmm. you know, underneath Manhattan or in New Zealand, or, you know, these sort of mega yachts that like ultra billionaires are building that can like stay at sea for like 4 or 5 years. It's when you read these articles, it's just in your back of mind, like, huh, they're really going to leave us out to hang. It's like, they're going to take your money and then sail away. And one of the lines that comes up in Billionaire Island and, you know, is that, you know, one of the guys confronts one of the billionaires and says, if you don't feel like you are committing a crime, then why did you build a getaway car? And this is the way I feel. I feel like, okay, we're seeing these people build getaway cars. Maybe that means that perhaps they are bank robbers.
Probably so. I mean, when I saw that the loans ran out for small businesses, but and yet millionaires are getting tax breaks, like it's insane. It's all so
insane. And most of those loans didn't even go to small businesses. They went to, you know, people who had relationships with the banks, who could fill out the paperwork in a timely fashion, and, you know, had the apparatus to take advantage of the fact there's very little oversight over who gets these loans. So even the small business loans weren't really designed or going to small businesses.
Mark, what do you do if Bezos sees your comic Billionaire Island and goes, wait a minute, he's caught onto my plan?
I think he'll probably revel in the fact that I'm powerless to stop him.
Oh God, you're so right. Oh,
you'll get a good snicker. You'll call Zuckerberg and say, hey, this guy on page 8 looks like you.
We could only hope. Maybe they'll learn something. Probably not. They're Anyway, so you've written across pretty much every facet of the comic industry at this point, between the big two, indies. How does your process differ when writing from for established properties versus indie? And a follow-up, do you prefer one over the other?
I kind of prefer the creator-owned, you know, because one, there's not the pressure. It's not, I don't have to worry about like something coming back later and saying, oh, legal said you can't, you know, you can't have this character like smoking, you know, or, you know, so there it's a lot, you're a lot freer when you're writing creator-owned sort of made-up properties. But on the other hand, you lose the cultural equity that you get when you're working with characters like the Flintstones, or for that matter, like Jesus Christ, somebody who has like a lot of cultural investment in them and that people instantly recognize. And when the character has that kind of power, like a Batman or Flintstones or whatever, then you can use the weight of that recognition to say things that people weren't expecting you to say, or to get them to listen to things that ordinarily they wouldn't listen to. So that's the benefit of working with established, you know, major properties. But then also you have to worry about getting that phone call saying, you know, we really can't have Fred Flintstone talking about how vitamin pills are crap, you know, which I have gotten.
Is there a big two superhero that you would like to take on and infuse yourself into?
Yeah, I would love to write a Superman series. He's sort of my favorite superhero of all time, just because I think that he's the ultimate thought experiment in a lot of ways. It's like, what would you do if you had this godlike power and you were invested in using it for, you know, humanity's benefit? It's like, what if you had everything, if you had all the powers you could possibly hope for, and you desperately cared about the future of the human race, what would be the thing that you could do to make it happen? To me, this is like sort of the thought experiment we should all be sort of engaging in. This is really what politics should be doing, is it should be asking itself, well, what would I do if I was Superman?
Last week, we did a whole segment on All-Star Superman and dug in a little bit. And you've probably read that series, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Okay. Switching gears just a little bit. What did you want to be when you were little?
Yeah, it kind of depended on which week you asked me.
Sure.
Yeah, I went through a lot of little phases when I was a kid. I would have been happy doing pretty much anything if I imagined myself working on like a space station or something, which I sort of did. I sort of imagined I'd always be like working in orbit around someplace, like wearing a unitard, you know, like a character in Space 1999 or Battlestar Galactica or something. But I think for most of my youth, I wanted to, I thought I would end up being a scientist of some kind.
Do you remember, a quick follow-up to that, do you remember the first comic issue that you read that made you think, I kind of want to do this, or at least want to try it?
Yeah, I feel like the first time I wasn't really, when I was a kid, I mostly read like, you know, Mighty Mouse, or, you know, sort of the pulp newsstand comics. So I didn't take them very seriously for a long time. It wasn't until I was in college and my friend Bryce, who I'm actually now working on a comic book series with, he gave me a copy of an issue of Sandman. And it was one where Caesar Augustus is pretending to be a beggar. One day a year, he pretends to be a beggar on the streets of Rome in the Forum as an old man, so he can see Rome without anyone being sort of Potemkinizing the city for him. And I just thought it was like a intellectual and majestic, like, and yet sort of intimate storytelling. And I thought, wow, this is like better than, you know, half the literary fiction that I've been forced to read in college. And it's a comic book. So it was really kind of the first time that I realized that this is like an art form that is come into its own. And it was in the 90s. I wasn't yet thinking that I would myself become a comic book writer, because I didn't really realize yet that I was a writer. But looking back on it, that was the first time that like I really thought, wow, this is like a medium that deserves some more attention.
Oh, it certainly does. You've probably been asked this 1,000 times, so I apologize. But Flintstones was an inspirational series. Would you ever want to take on another property, a similar property like that, and put your spin on it for 12 issues?
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that. If the Hanna-Barbera stuff hadn't gone away, if DC hadn't stopped, licensing the Hanna-Barbera stuff, I would have liked to have done a follow-up series after Snagglepuss following the Huckleberry Hound character, the son of Huckleberry Hound that shows up at the end, and about him like being a stand-up comedian in the 70s, like hanging out with guys like George Carlin and, you know, Richard Pryor in the sort of like stand-up comedy scene.
Nice. Do an SNL episode.
Yeah. Do an SNL or at least like a Smothers Brothers or something.
There you go.
Okay. I keep getting the simple ones. What one artist that you haven't worked with before do you most want to work with?
Oh, man, there's so many artists out there that whose artwork I really love. Nick Darrington's a guy who I just absolutely adore and love it. I was just thinking about I was going to say Doc Shaner, but I did work with him for like 8 pages on an anthology. But I would love to work with him again, too. I just think his work. Oh, Steve Lieber, another one.
Nice.
So you, when you're starting a project out, I would imagine it varies between indie publishers and, you know, the big two. But do you often have an artist already attached to the book, or do you seek out an artist that you think will be right tonally?
Yeah, it's usually the second. Usually I sign up to do a project. Then it's like, okay, well, now let's find an artist. And it's this sort of, I wish I could say that, I'm sitting on Mount Olympus just picking the artist who's got the right tonality and is perfect for this book. And of course, they jump at the chance to work on it.
They're all magically free and eager.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's mostly a matter of scheduling. It's about who is available and willing to work on a series, as opposed to, you know, getting the creamy, lucrative, you know, cover work, and is willing to stick with you for like 6 to 12 issues and is available. And so I've been very lucky in that, you know, that really brilliant artists like, you know, Steve Pugh and, you know, Mike Vian and Ben Caldwell have just sort of fallen in my lap at different points.
Steve's great. He's been on the show before, too. We were talking about the Harley book you did with Mariko Tamaki.
Yeah, that's a great book, by the way.
Oh, so good. And I love how it's all one story wrapped up in one book, right? You can just finish it and you're done.
Yeah, it's like that's what happens when you prioritize storytelling in a comic and you're not just trying to like churn out something to fill the crap factory, but you're actually like using this as a medium to tell stories that people will engage with.
He said something on that interview too. Like he was saying, you know, when he was getting to the end of the book, he actually was realizing the faces were changing. So he went back and changed all the faces at the beginning of the book. Like that's fascinating to me that you're looking at it in that way. And it's like the art is evolving.
Yeah, it has to. I mean, it's very hard to maintain. It's the same thing happens within the writing where it's hard to maintain that sort of tonal consistency throughout because your sort of conception of your relationship to these characters changes as you're going forward in writing. So it really is helpful to, if you're not publishing something as one book, to have as much of it written as possible before it starts actually, the artwork actually starts. Because a lot of times you'll go back and you'll say, this character has got, I feel more sympathy for this character now than I did at the beginning. So I don't want them to look as evil. I don't want them to act as, you know, one dimensional at the beginning, because they've gone through some changes and now I see that they have this complexity that I didn't originally imbue them with at the end. But I imagine it's very similar for artists. You begin seeing them at some point as human beings.
Huh. Yeah, so true. Well, Mark, we're at the last question of the show and it's off topic, top shelf. We're going to ask you something that's not comics related that you're into right now. It could be anything. It could be books, movies, food, anything.
Well, right now, and especially with the sheltering at home and sort of the whole COVID-19 thing, one thing I've kind of been into lately is stoicism, by which I mean like sort of the ancient Roman sort of
philosophical pop, approach.
Yeah, sure. Philosophers. And a lot of people sort of equate stoicism with being like, well, whatever happens to you, just take it and, you know, accept it, which is not really what it's about. It's more about saving your energy for things you can change, like not freaking out and saving your emotional and mental energy like a boxer who chooses their punches. You're saving it for when you can make the most difference. It's really about maximizing. It's kind of the opposite of what people think it is, which is just sort of like being this jellyfish who is okay with being stepped on. It's really more about maximizing your impact on the world by not exhausting yourself, freaking out about every little thing. And I've been reading the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, some of which I, you know, and there's one like quote here or there, which I think is especially profound or meaningful. I'll sort of paraphrase it to make it work in modern English, and I'll post it on Twitter. Also the works of Seneca, a lot of that is really good. That's one sort of thing that's really helped sort of get me through the existential malaise of sheltering in place and not knowing what the future holds, is this whole idea of being calm within and focusing on who you are and what you want to accomplish in life.
That's some strong wisdom we could take onto the show, right, Forrest?
Sure. I had a quick follow-up for both of you, probably.
Oh, no.
I just learned this yesterday, actually. Did you know that Plato was his wrestling name?
Yeah, I did. That's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah.
What kind of wrestling?
Like Greco-Roman wrestling.
Oh, he wasn't in a ring jumping off the banister?
No, I don't think so.
Although I think at that time it was just Greco.
Right.
But it's crazy, isn't it? Yeah, it meant like broad-shouldered one, because he was like known for having especially broad shoulders.
That's
so
badass.
Plato is like plateau, yeah. Like flat. Yeah.
And then more people knew him as that. So at some point in his life, he was just like, well, all right.
So are you telling me The Rock should play him in a movie?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time. This is a pleasure and a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been a blast, guys. Thanks a lot.